Okay, good afternoon. Welcome to this session, which is about adaptive physiology. My name is Alistair Proudfoot. I'm delighted to be chairing this session along with Ramani Munasinghe. I think you'll already gather from the kit on stage that this is going to be innovative, exciting. So I will shut up and get on with the main event. So delighted to welcome Tom Evans, who's a consultant in emergency medicine at Imperial College Healthcare, also works with London's Air Ambulance. Melanie Wilson, who is a British Olympian and one of these rare people who is able to do many things, and so she simultaneously, whilst training for the Olympics, also trained in medicine, works in Northwest London and wants to pursue a career in anaesthetics. And Mark Homer, who's been a physiologist with the British Olympic team, rowing team, and will continue to prep them going forward into the Tokyo Olympics. So I'll hand over to Tom. Look forward to it.
Thanks very much, and good afternoon. Thank you for the invitation to speak at what's been such a fantastic meeting. There's three of us here, three doctors, two of whom are clinicians and one of whom is a real doctor, but we're here representing three different roles in elite sport, really. I'm here as a coach, Mel is here as an athlete, and Mark is here as a physiologist. And along with strength and conditioning coaches, we're all incredibly motivated to understand as much as we can about this unique patient population, if you like, of elite athletes who compete in strength endurance sports. We have no personal conflicts of interest, but we're being supported in this session by COSMED, who provided gas analysis, and you'll see more of that going on during the session. And we are providing references during the talk, but if you'd like to see the references, if you go to bit.ly/realtimeextremephysiology, you can find all our references there. So on the off chance that everyone here is not a massive rowing fan, I might just explain to you a little bit about the physiological challenge that we're talking about. Olympic rowing is raced over 2,000 metres on a straight course, and the athletes that take part vary both in terms of gender and also weight category. So the race takes somewhere between 5.5 and 8.5 minutes, depending on conditions. The recipe for rowing is pretty simple. It's a power sport, which means we ask the athletes to move a load about 80% of their body weight about 230 times over the course of that race on a cycle of about once every 1.5 seconds. And there are three components. The ability to generate power is critical, and that's what we're talking about today. But technique is also crucial. And so our athletes have to use large muscle groups to generate power, and small muscle groups and posture to create a chain of connection and also to provide precision. And they have to do all of this whilst on a moving platform in synchrony with all of the other people in their crew and whilst maintaining a strategic overview of what's going on in the race. And then performance is the third component, and that's how good they are at getting their power and their technique onto the race. And we're accountable and we're motivated for understanding all of the components that can help us generate the most of each of those.
Thanks, Tom. So I thought I would explain to you... it's not what I was hoping it would be. Ah, there we go. Sorry about this. Third time lucky. Yes. Okay, so as Tom explained, rowing is quite a unique sport in the Olympic family of events. Tom did describe that it was a strength endurance sport. The primary energy system utilised by rowing is the endurance system, but it does rely quite heavily on glycolytic pathways such as anaerobic glycolysis and the creatine phosphate system, less so on the fat side of energy production. To explain where rowing fits in the sort of Olympic system, you can kind of put it on this strength endurance chart. As you will see, there's no real events down at the bottom left-hand corner, because to be in the Olympics, you have to be good at one of those elements. And if you look at the top left-hand corner, you have a pure weightlifter who has lots of power and strength required, but no endurance. And then as we move across the endurance phase, we can see a long jumper who has to run down the track and produce a high amount of power to deliver a jump. We've then got Chris Hoy, who will do a kilometre on the track, so he's more in the glycolytic anaerobic pathway. Jessica Ennis, who will perform 7 events of differing technique and physiology. Andy Murray. We then get towards the more endurance end of the spectrum with Christina Rugu, who does 400 metres, so that is sort of that limit of that anaerobic glycolysis. And then we move into the more extreme endurance events, such as open water swimming with Kerri-Anne Payne, who will swim 10 kilometres, and Mo Farah, obviously, who will now run a marathon, which is a sub-maximal aerobic-dominated event. And this is where rowing fits in that spectrum. So you're required to deliver high amounts of force and power, but primarily as an endurance event, because as Tom said, the event will last somewhere between 5.5 and 6 minutes. 5.5 and 8 minutes, sorry. Now, because endurance is the most dominant factor in that performance, we spend a lot of our time trying to develop the aerobic capacity of our rowers, because it is the most influential element of the race. So we like to picture this as we're trying to bake a cake. We're trying to build that aerobic endurance that we can then put some anaerobic topping on when we get to the race event. If we don't develop a big cake, we don't bake a big cake, we end up trying to put too much icing on it, and that isn't sustainable because the demands of rowing are beyond VO2 max. You will compete at an intensity that is not sustainable at VO2 max. So there has to be some additional contribution from alternative energy supply as we go. So what we're actually trying to do is build an enormous cupcake with a nice, appropriately sized dollop of anaerobic icing on the top, ready for our race. Now, it's very difficult for us to visualize the anaerobic and the aerobic contribution during a 2K race live. What we can do, and what COSMED will do for us today, is demonstrate the aerobic contribution. Now, with a clever bit of math, we're able to quite accurately say how much of the power produced is due to aerobic metabolism. That's because in skilled rowers, there's a very tight relationship between VO2, oxygen consumption, and power produced. So if we do an incremental step test, it's a very tight relationship, and you can kind of say with a degree of certainty that when a rower is producing 340 watts on the ergo, they're about 5.3 litres of oxygen. And then even if you extend that to VO2 max, that relationship remains. So we can kind of explain how much of the energy, how much of the power delivered is produced by aerobic means. Now, this is quite a complicated graph, but the blue line at the top represents the power of the ergometer throughout a test. You kind of get this soup bowl effect in a rowing race with a fast start, a steady middle, and then a push at the end. What we're going to see live on the kit today is this red thick line, which is the oxygen consumption. Now, you see a very quick increase in oxygen consumption to meet the demands of the race. And that's quite interesting for us physiologists because we turn that VO2 kinetics and we're interested in how we can maximise and speed up VO2 kinetics to maintain a high aerobic contribution. The dotted line that you can see across the top is the power associated with VO2 max. So that is Mel's almost upper limit for aerobic contribution. And you can see the way we've scaled this graph, there's a gap between that and the power that she would need to produce. So we've got our VO2 max that she will reach. We hopefully she'll reach halfway through the race. And then anything that she produces at the end, we're looking at an anaerobic capacity, the need for a sprint finish, which she'll find something extra that will have to be beyond that aerobic contribution. So when you look at this graph, anything below that line will be an aerobic contribution to the race, and anything above it, and at the beginning and the sprint finish, will be an anaerobic contribution. So that's what you'll be seeing a sort of estimation of that, the VO2 line on the K5 when we're presenting. So look at what Alex talk us through that as Mel does her race. We're going to play the Olympic final from Rio behind Mel as she delivers a performance at the same time. If you do know the results, if you've read your bio, keep it to yourself for now, because there might be a few people who haven't seen the result or know what the result is, so it could be quite exciting. So I think we're now ready to watch Mel perform her race.
Next date.
Okay, we just have to watch.
Can we have the volume up?
Yeah. Some volume, please. We'll go. Okay, now, a rowing race is characterised by an incredibly hard maximal start. Now, the first reason for that is to overcome the drag of the shell sitting in water. So a women's eight boat will weigh about 96 kilos on its own. You then have to add in 75 to 80 kilo women in there and a 50 kilo cox. So it's quite a body to overcome the initial drag of going still. So it's a maximal start. Also, it's important to be ahead as quickly as you can, so you have a tactical advantage. Because you're traveling backwards, you want to see the rest of the race map out behind you, and then you can respond to the tactics of the other competitors. So they're rating very high, and they're now sort of reaching the transition into the middle section of the race. Now, the middle section of the race is where aerobic metabolism dominates. As you look at the screen, GB are the yellow boat, third from the bottom. Yeah. The favourites for this race were the American crew, the Olympic champions from London 2012. You've also got Canada in there. You've got Holland, New Zealand, Romania, and of course us. So this is 500 metres, so we're a quarter of the way through the race now. So we're really into that aerobic dominated sport. And you can see now when we look at the data on the left-hand side, we've seen this sharp increase as I displayed in the demonstration graph at the start. We've seen this increase and we're now starting to level, we should start to level out with the oxygen consumption. Now the K5 utilizes a mixing chamber technology, which overcomes some of the problems that you might see with a breath by breath system at high breathing frequencies. Now rowing has an entrained breathing pattern due to the rhythmic nature of the stroke, which means you often see some quite strange big breath, little breath breathing patterns. So by utilising this mixing chamber technology, the K5 will overcome that. It does mean there's a slight delay. So what you're seeing is a few seconds behind what Mel is delivering. So we're now, you'll see that VO2 starting to settle down. You probably noticed, the more astute of you, that Mel is rating slightly lower than the guys in the video. That's because the row machine, while it's an excellent tool, a great training, consistent training tool for rowers. The technology used, the air brake technology, is quite a heavy feeling. It's quite hard to pull on that stroke, even on the light setting. So even on the lightest setting, a rowing machine will be heavier than putting your blade in the water and pulling a stroke. That's why she rates slightly lower on the machine than she does in the race. That VO2 is still rising. We've now got the Americans out in front, the Canadians in second, and the Dutch in third. Should start to see the British boat appear on your screens. They're currently down in sixth. We're well over the 1,000 now. About to come up to the 1,500. So now these guys are working maximally aerobically, and the cost of that extra anaerobic contribution will be starting to tell. And remember, as Tom discussed earlier, it's a highly technical sport as well as a physical sport. So they've got to maintain that rhythm, maintain that synchronicity with their teammates while the fatigue is setting in. Oh, yeah. So if you look at the right-hand side of the screen on the COSMED data, we're seeing we can see RQ. So that is a calculated version of respiratory exchange ratio, and that will tell us what fuel Mel is burning. At rest, you're about 0.8 ratio of oxygen in to carbon dioxide out. When you're burning pure carbohydrate, you'll be at 1.15. So that suggests that Mel is now working maximally, but heart rate of 181. And you can see that VO2 has settled out. So she's burning pure carbohydrate now. The demands of the event are so high, fat metabolism is too slow to add any sustained input at this point. So Mel is burning pure carbohydrate to provide the energy for this test. We're getting towards the end now. GB have crept up. Might be some commentary on the sound. No, I'll have to do it. So we've got the Americans by out in front, but GB have fought their way back through the crowd of boats in this last 500, and they're now holding on to second position. We're approaching the line now. The Americans are length in front, fighting it out with the Romanians. Ooh. Well done, Mel. Now, I haven't got the time to produce that graph that I showed you earlier straight away, but this is actually a similar thing from when Mel was rowing in the build-up to that Rio Olympics. And it kind of shows that standard profile about how she's delivered that 2K. You can see the blue line of the profile. And you see she's got relatively quick VO2 kinetics, Mel. So she gets up and gets the aerobic system moving earlier. And that means that that dark grey area that she has to use anaerobic pathways to meet the demands of the race, that means she's actually got a little bit more left to use at the end. So we've sort of saved a bit of that anaerobic by getting the aerobic system going quickly. You see the sprint finish, how the rate and the speed increase to the end. She manages to find that extra bit of power. Interestingly, what you do actually see sometimes is this decrease in VO2 towards the end of a race. In the rowing world, that is known as switching to guns. So in an attempt to find a bit more speed, the rate will often go up. It becomes more of an arm-driven stroke, and it's sort of like this, and you're using smaller, less aerobic muscles, so you actually the demand for oxygen from the big muscles reduces. And you sort of add more of an anaerobic contribution. Last thing, so as I said, rowers are all big aerobic machines, but within a group of rowers, you will find slight differences in the way they can meet the demands of the race. And you can kind of look at this from a sort of size of engine and economical engine. That's my 74 camper there in the top left-hand corner. Small engine, very uneconomical. And a smart car is a small engine, very economic. And what you find with endurance athletes, particularly rowers, is they all appear in this element. The ones that haven't got the biggest VO2 maxes will tend to be more economical, whereas the really big engines will tend to be slightly less economical, and that's how they meet the demands of the race.
So what we just saw was a maximal effort, and I think we all just appreciate the work that Mel's just put in to demonstrate an Olympic level piece, which is not something that we would ask the athletes to do very often in the course of a training year. Mel is going to deliver some of the talk later, and what we do now is going to depend slightly on how fast she recovers. But in the meantime, Mark is going to take a series of post-exercise lactates so we can see what has actually happened to her lactate state afterwards. And it's interesting to say, really, we don't know what the limit is of what is possible, but we do know that the limit is quite extreme. And the brilliant thing about these guys is that they can get to that extreme point quite quickly. There's a piece of work that was done with the Danish rowing team. Now, one of the problems with studying this is that nobody shares because we're in competition with each other. But we know that the Danes tend to train in a very high intensity way. So they try and make a smaller
cake with a bigger bit of icing on the top. And they've had quite a bit of success with that. And at the European Championships, they took some gases immediately after the Danes, two of whom had just won an Olympic gold medal, to see what their physiology was like immediately that they got off the erg. And this was a staked race. It counted. So we can trust that they made a maximal effort. And this is what they found. pH of 6.74, lactate of 32, and no bicarbonate whatsoever. And what's quite impressive about this is that these guys had just succeeded. They had not failed. They delivered a very strong performance and had also not died. So in the second half of our time, we're going to answer these questions. What do we think is going on in this unsustainable zone when we're working over threshold? Now, I'm aware we're talking to a room which is predominantly anaesthetists. I think some of you have already done some kind of step testing and are aware of when you're training at threshold. And if you could think of what we've been doing as essentially wet cycling, I think it fits with probably what you've experienced. What is going on in this unsustainable zone, both at a cellular level and also within the muscles? We're going to talk about what it feels like, because extreme physiology is not comfortable, and our patients are experiencing extreme physiology, and I think that's a useful insight. We're going to try and answer the question, why are they not dead? And we're going to try and answer the question, what's going on with this lactate of 34? And when Mel's feeling better, she's going to interrupt me, so the order of this is flexible. There are adaptive mechanisms that go on to enable a delivery of performance during the course of a piece, both in terms of a macro level, increasing cardiac output, dilatation, allowing increased DO2, and also as a consequence of the acidosis. So we know when athletes become acidotic at maximal energy, the oxygen dissociation curve shifts to the right, more oxygen is released in the cells. And if we put a SATS probe on Mel at the end of that piece, we'd have got SATS somewhere between, peripheral SATS, somewhere between 80 and 85%, I expect. But as they spend time in this supra-threshold zone, certain fatiguing elements come in, and they are both central and peripheral. And when you when people look with magnetic stimulation, about 40%, 30 to 40% of the fatigue that we see is actually central, either cortical or transmission or neuromuscular transmission, and only 60% of it is actually what's going on in the muscle. What do we know? Well, type 3 and 4 muscle afferents, so the nociceptive, the chemoceptive afferents, are stimulated by hypoxia, they're stimulated by lactate, they're stimulated by protons, and they have a central down-regulating effect on motor activity. Serotonin is also strongly associated with fatigue. Serotonin is obviously only synthesized in the brain and cannot cross the blood-brain barrier, but the precursor for it can, tryptophan can, and tryptophan competes with branched-chain amino acids for transport across the blood-brain barrier. So as the piece progresses and branched-chain amino acids are used up, that ratio changes, more tryptophan crosses. And we know that if we, not obviously in rowing, but if we provide ongoing glucose during the effort, then you reduce the amount of tryptophan that crosses the blood-brain barrier. IL-6 is produced by muscles in extremis, and that is associated with central fatigue. And as amino acids are metabolized, ammonia goes up, and that is also associated with reduced motor cortical activity. And athletes quite often describe, at the end of a piece, a kind of a closing in, a tunnel vision, a bright light, all those things. And it may be that the end is approaching, but it may be that actually the brain, which has very limited stores of glycogen, is entering a glycogen-deplete state. And then peripherally, what's happening in the muscle? Well, we know that inorganophosphate comes up and cyclohemal protons both increase, and this is associated with reduced cross-bridge formation and therefore reduced muscle activation. Calcium uptake is impaired, which potentially reduces people's fine motor control. Mel's going to talk to us about that. And actually, contracting a muscle in itself can create a local ischemia. And if you test isometric contraction, you can reduce delivery of oxygen by about 40% if you're in a constant tank hold. And then as heat goes up, cross-bridge formation goes down. So there's a number of factors which, as they spend time in this extreme zone, mitigate against power production.
Okay. Yeah, Does this work? Hello? So most of our training in the team was done not only a very long time before I started working in the NHS, but at a very different intensity to what you just saw. So, and certainly not at the intensity of racing an Olympic final. So I'm just going to talk a little bit, slightly out of breath for realism, about what it feels like to train at those different intensities and suggest some like physiological reasons, as Tom started to do. So because of the nature of rowing being such an aerobic sport, the vast majority is done at a low intensity. So I think my lactate is 15 now. Normally it's done at 2. That's our base level of training, and that's what we spend thousands of hours doing. And then a smaller proportion is done at in a kind of middle zone, and that's a lactate generally like about 4 to 7. And those sessions are kind of closer to racing intensity, and they're tougher, but they are kind of manageable. So they've got a physiological cost at the time and a physiological cost in recovery, because it takes much longer to recover for them. So when you're training and your lactate is about 4, you feel a bit uncomfortable. When it's at 7, you feel like your breathing starts to shift to kind of accommodate that increased demand, and your lungs are feeling a little bit burny, I suppose. And it's kind of tolerable but significant, I would say. And I say that because I think that's, I've been in ITU for the last 4 months, and that's the kind of level that you see when patients are really unwell, or they're getting to be unwell. And I think for an athlete, it's kind of tolerable because you've experienced it so many times before in training. You know when it's going to end, and you're familiar with it. But I just think, I don't know if a patient feels in any way as we do, but I think if I was lying stock still in bed with whatever disease process was causing that acidotic state, on top of those feelings, I think it would be like totally terrifying, to be honest. So the final kind of 2 or 3% of our training was done above threshold. So I haven't seen the curves, but that's hopefully what I was trying to demonstrate then. And that's when you start producing lactate levels of kind of over 15. And how people perceive those feelings are really individual. There's some similarities, but equally, some people are able to generate and tolerate really high levels of lactate, and other people can't. And it's not at all a marker on their power or strength or toughness. It's just an individual quirk. Because I asked around the girls that you saw racing with me then, I said, how do you feel in the second half of a race? And some of it was relatively new to me, to be honest, because we don't talk about it that much. And so I just thought I'd put up what some of the girls said. So that's Jess, who rode in the crew a few seats in front of me, and she said, it's like you're in the middle of a fire. Polly said her teeth feel like they're going to fall out. And quite a few people feel things around their jaw and teeth. I don't know why that is. And then that's Fran. She rode in 5 Olympics and 3 Olympic silver medals, and she said there's no way out, and no matter how hard you pray, and also commented that none of our quotes were, doesn't all this training work well? and then that's Olivia. She rode in second from the front in our crew, and she said her legs felt hard and heavy like tree trunks. And then the last one's Rude, so I left the name out. But people feel some really horrible extreme things, so I was in two minds whether to put it in. But anyway, there it is. So it all sounds really overdramatic, and anyone that knows rowing as a community, they love to go on about how hard they push themselves. But in reality, I think the more training you do, the more you learn to recognize those feelings, and they often mean that you're kind of on the edge of what in sport we call blowing. And it's something that you do definitely a lot of times, and hopefully by the time you get to a race, you recognize when that feeling is coming. So blowing is really different to exhaustion, I would say. Like exhaustion and fatigue, you can come back from with psychological things. So if you're in a race and you're feeling really exhausted, but you start moving on a crew, or someone behind you says something really inspiring, you can often turn that around and keep going. If you've blown, it's really abrupt, and once it's happened, you can't really come back from it, or I've never experienced being able to come back from it without a significant period of kind of rest and recovery. So if that happens, if you blow 20 seconds after crossing a finish line, that's totally fine, but if it's kind of 20 seconds before, it's pretty catastrophic, to be honest. So as I said, the longer you train, the more you come to kind of recognize those feelings, and that sensation might be imminent, and you can adjust your efforts accordingly. The kind of scientific basis around why that happens is quite poorly understood. So Olivia's comment on feeling really like her legs were hard and firm is quite a common one, and people often feel tingling around their mouth and in their hands and feet, and some people have suggested that because you become so acidotic, it gives you end up with more free calcium, and that could contribute to those feelings. We also know that as you approach failure, you lose a lot of muscular control, and we know there's kind of a reduced concentration of acetylcholine in the presynaptic vesicles, so that is kind of the sensation that you feel that you've lost a lot of control. So obviously, I'm in no way comparing what I did then to someone who's horribly ill in hospital, but I think I suppose the whole point of the presentation is that we hope there's something that could be gleaned from athletes that kind of push themselves to the limit and push themselves to an extreme state, but then come back from it and not only learn to understand their own physiology, but also learn to somehow manipulate it and work with it. That's all.
So Mel's 2-minute recovery lactate was 14.9 and her 5-minute lactate was 15.8. And we quite often see this pattern of actually after the load is reduced, the lactate continues to rise. And we, I think, in sport, like in medicine, have a complicated relationship with lactate. We use it because we can measure it, and it's over time proved to be a really useful marker of the training load. If we got presented with a patient with a lactate of 34 and a pH of 6.7, we'd probably think we need to do something about it, and maybe we need to fix that lactate. But certainly, when we look at what is going on in the muscles during extreme exertion, the lactate is probably not the problem, and it's actually probably helping. When muscles are working at full capacity, it's actually the extra mitochondrial ATP turnover and the cyclohemoglycolysis, which is producing all the excess protons, which is creating the intracellular acidosis, which is pushing these athletes towards failure. And it's worth saying that we encourage them to find out where they do fail, because we want them to fail, but we want them to fail 2 seconds after they've crossed the finish line. And being excellent at managing that is one of the ways that you are successful. And lactate is helpful because it's actually mopping up protons. If the pyruvate that is being converted to lactate has come from glucose originally, then it mops up 2 protons. If it's come from glycogen, which we're using at the beginning of the race, then it mops up 1. And then lactate is co-transported with a proton out of the cells. So in terms of actually relieving the intracellular acidosis, lactate is very helpful. We're familiar, I think, with the lactate shuttle theory, and that's definitely important for us in extreme exercise, because lactate is actually a potent energy source and is particularly taken up by heart and brain. And in exercise, 75% of the lactate that's produced is then oxidized into tissue for energy, and only 25% goes back through the Cori cycle for gluconeogenesis. So lactate is important, and when we look at the full gamut of athletes in our system, and I think I will agree, athletes that can't produce lactate have to modify how they race, because they tend not to have that kick that's needed at the end. And Mel is an excellent lactate producer, which is a really useful part of her sporting profile. So lactate is an advantage, and we can train people to try and get some of that advantage. So we can only spend a small amount of our training time training people in this lactate tolerance zone, but what they learn is really critical. So the first thing is that the main barrier to performance for most of us is pain. But actually, when we are confident in our bodies, we can progress through that pain barrier. And being familiar with what that sensation is like is really important. It also is critical that when the athletes are in that moment of extremists, they have the ability to maintain their form. So they have to be able to direct their energy towards maintaining form and posture and aggression, so that when they're in this pre-blowing state, they're able to be as effective as they were when they were comfortable. And you can train the lactate system to an extent. Legs are very good for studying, because we have two. So this group in Amsterdam trained one leg of some subjects with some isometric strength test training over 7 weeks, left the other leg alone. And what they found was that in those people, you could increase expression of both the lactate hydrogen pump in muscles, and actually separately, you could increase MCT expression in the other tissues. So you can train people to use their lactate better. Finally, why don't they die? We don't really know. But we do know that they don't tend to die. And that's important because we're lottery funded. And there's only so many. And in fact, this kind of extreme sport is really quite safe. Firstly, because the important conditions we now screen for in terms of cardiac conditions and channelopathies to protect our athletes, but also because there is clearly something acting as a governor. And the fatigue processes that we identified earlier on mean that as the athlete gets towards the extremis, they blow, and the consequence of that is that the work done massively drops off, because they then cannot connect to work and they cannot generate work. So we don't know, but an important theory is the self-governor theory, which suggests that the body just won't let you get to the point of expiration, and the skill of the athletes is getting as close as you can to the governor to win the race. We saw a photo finish in Rio, and that race represented the culmination of a lifetime's commitment by the athletes in that crew, and also many, many athletes that had been in our women's eight before. That was our first ever medal in the women's eight at the Olympics. And there are only 60 people who've been in that boat beforehand, building to this point. Support staff, physiologists, strength and conditioning coaches, doctors, coaches, bringing us to that point that was a photo finish. And what we know in sport is that we have to try and make good decisions every time, because those good decisions add up. And what they add up to in the end is what you may have seen in the bio, which is a silver medal. And we were so proud when we saw that happen. Thanks very much.